from the Hill Country of Texas, this is One Radio Network. And a very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone, and you've got OneRadioNetwork.com. OneRadioNetwork.com. It is December 28, 2009, and we are not really here this morning. But wait a minute, I'm talking, and how come I'm not really here? Well, it's just really magic, because I'm in coming back from St. Louis, and you're coming back from Christmas. And it's really just before Christmas when we're talking with Adrian Salbucci, who is in Buenos Aires. Señor Salbucci, ¿qué pasa? How are you?
Good morning. Congratulations on your excellent Spanish.
Yeah, right. That's about it, man. I know.
Well, it's something. It's something.
I know dura cabeza and, hard head and, something like Chico and something like that. How are you, Mr. Salbucci?
Just fine. Keeping fit. It's very warm down here. It's very hot.
Really? You always have a warm Christmas there in Buenos Aires?
Yes, because it's in the Southern Hemisphere, Christmas and New Year's are always in the summer months, so we're actually having sort of a heat wave here. It's about 90 degrees in the shade.
Uh-huh. Adrian Salbucci is an interesting man. He has been consulting companies as an independent guy for a while in financial matters and their risk kind of management. He's had a great interest in economy, geopolitics, and the New World Order for a lot of years. He wrote a couple of books in Spanish to introduce these ideas in Buenos Aires way about the CFR and also about geopolitics. CFR stands for what, Adrian Salbucci?
Well, for the Council on Foreign Relations, yes, I sort of kicked off with this whole matter about over 10 years ago when I wrote a book. The Spanish title would translate into English something like The World's Mastermind, The Hidden Face of Globalization.
Wow.
Where I analyzed all the how the various think tanks have been so influential over major world events over the past 70, 80 years. And I concentrated particularly on the Council on Foreign Relations that was founded in 1919 and how it blends into a whole network of similar think tanks that would include the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and even a local branch in Argentina, which is, it translates something like the Argentine Council on Foreign Relations. It's got a similar name.
Uh-huh. You know, it's difficult for many, including your host here, Mr. Salbucci, to kind of get my head around the possible enormity and significance of lots of people, very well connected, very high up in the geopolitical strata, control and monetary, to think that this is really going on. I don't doubt it. It's just I can assume for most it's difficult to even really believe these kinds of things.
Well, let me put this into perspective. I'll tell you the way I see it, because very often anybody who tries to delve into these matters and study them at depth, in depth and so forth, you're automatically branded a conspiracy theorist. The whole idea of a conspiracy theory has become degraded. It sort of disqualifies any idea. If you say, well, people get together and they plan out what's going to happen in the world, they say, oh, come on, that's a conspiracy theory. But I think that it's just a way of fighting back from the very power structure that is running the world. Because let me give you an example. Isn't it logical that people who wield a lot of power, by wield a lot of power, I mean people who are very strong in banking, people who are very strong in multimedia, in the world's media, people who have a lot of political power, people who are very rich and wealthy, all the persons who wield a lot of power, either because they are the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies or they themselves are shareholders in major corporations and so forth – Wouldn't it be logical that every now and then Mr. Rockefeller will pick up the phone and speak to Mr. Rothschild, and Mr. Rothschild will pick up the phone and speak to Mr. Bush, and Mr. Bush will pick up the phone and speak to, I don't know, Mr. Agnelli from Fiat in Italy, and that they should coordinate their actions, each from his own specific sphere, whether it be in banking, in biz, in multimedia outlets, whether it be in universities where people are being formed for the future, whether it be in government, whether it be in the multilateral agencies like the IMF and so forth. Isn't it logical that they should pick up the phone every now and then and even get together every now and then and say, well, how do we move the world forward so that it will promote our interests, at least those interests that we have in common, and not any other interests? Actually, when you look at it from that point, it's logical human nature that people who have common interests should get together and plan together. The absurd thing would be to think that they never pick up the phone, that they would never think of getting together and seeing how they can move forward through common action towards common goals and the defense of common interests.
Yeah, it wouldn't make much sense not to talk to those kinds of people. I mean, these are the people that are kind of in the same genre and level of control or power that you have. I mean, why wouldn't you talk to them?
Yeah, and let me give you let me put it another way. Would you call a board meeting at Exxon behind closed doors a conspiracy of 7 or 8 or 10 gentlemen to get together and make a lot of money through the exploitation and sale of oil and gasoline? You could call it a conspiracy. I would say, listen, don't call it a conspiracy. It's basic common sense. They're just doing business, and it's just fine that they should be doing business. And Exxon is a very successful company. And we could say the same thing for just about any other company or private enterprise that you can think of. It's not a conspiracy that people get together and see how they can make much more money penetrating in markets, selling their product at the highest possible cost, and producing it at the lowest possible cost so that they can have a big margin. There's nothing conspirational about that. It's basic common sense. It's human nature. So to call that a conspiracy would be absurd, just as it is absurd to say, well, there are think tanks and groups and organizations that bring together the very powerful, and once they have brought them together, they plan out how best to mold the world so that it will promote their objectives and not somebody else's, and it would be human nature for them to do that. The absurd thing, as I say, would be to think that they would never do that.
And can it also be argued, Adrian Salbucci, that the same goes for the Federal Reserve banks and the Federal Reserve Board of Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the people that really create the dollars and monetize these notes? I mean, this is all legal. It's all above board. It may be, you know, very inflationary because they're diluting the dollar because they're creating more of them. But it's legal. I mean, everybody knows they do it. Well, not everybody, but most people, well, some people, you know, know that. And this is just the way they do business.
Well, it's absolutely legal. As I say, that's why to even think about conspiracies is I think rather ridiculous, or it's a way of disqualifying other ideas. The Federal Reserve system, with its main branch in New York City and its political head in Washington, D.C., they are the ones who actually control the dollar. And in a way, you can't think of the Federal Reserve Board as a completely independent entity. It is probably quite independent of government, and it is quite independent of Congress, but it is definitely not independent of the banks, because it's the private banks of the United States of America that own 97% of the shares of the Federal Reserve Board. In other words, the Federal Reserve System in America is basically a private entity owned by the private bank. And it would be logical to think that Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Alan Greenspan before him, their work is very much geared, amongst other things, not just, but amongst other things, towards defending and promoting the interest of the major banks. When you look at it from that point of view, then you can begin to understand why the American government, either under the Republicans with George Bush or under the Democrats with Obama, are literally throwing and have been throwing trillions of dollars on the banks in order to save them, whilst I am sure they have not been throwing trillions of dollars to the American taxpayer to help them pay their mortgages. It's not conspirational. It's that you must understand that systemically, the Federal Reserve Board is really owned, operated, and geared on defending the interest of the major banks. When you add to that that the Treasury Department has practically been taken over by Goldman Sachs, with Mr. Geithner now and with Mr. Paulson before him, they were both, or their teams have a very strong presence of Goldman Sachs directors or ex-directors, then you figure, well, it's very easy to understand why the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Board would also then coordinate actions to preserve the banking system and the bankers' interests, and not so much to preserve the interests of the American people.
I wonder how it is your way in Argentina. Here, we're just really beginning, I would suspect more so with food than anything, beginning to feel some of the effects of this new money and inflationary pressures just a bit. In food, but not much else yet anywhere else. What is it like in Argentina, and what are your theories of why we haven't seen more inflation with all this several trillion dollars that have been created?
Well, basically, first of all, I would point out, Patrick, that Argentina has had the fourth largest recorded hyperinflationary process in history. I think the first one was in Zambia, the second worst one was in Hungary. Germany had its hyperinflation in the 1920s, and the fourth worst case was Argentina in 1989.
So you guys have experienced that. I mean, you know what hyperinflation would be, right?
Oh, absolutely. We had 10,000% inflation in all of 1989. The main difference between normal inflation, if I can call it that, and hyperinflation is that with normal inflation, well, even if it's very high, everything rises more or less in a balanced way and at the same time. In other words, prices go up, but your salary will go up at the same time. A liter of, I don't know, a gallon of gasoline might cost the same as, I don't know, 3 gallons of Coke or 4 gallons of milk. And that sort of keeps on par. But when you have hyperinflation, everything breaks down and prices just rise and there's no relationship amongst them, and especially with your salary. So when you have hyperinflation, you run the risk, which is what happened in Argentina, of the supply chain breaking down because people just don't know at what price to sell and at what price to deliver goods. So they just stop delivering goods. Now, why did Argentina have hyperinflation in 1989? Well, the obvious answer is the government printed too much money. Okay, that makes sense.
Now, let me stop you for a second. Now, can you give us an idea, because we talk a lot about the money supply and how much is out there, Mr. Salbucci, and the percentage of increase. Do you know some of the specifics on that, just to give us a point of reference of how much the Argentine, is it peso, was increased and what percentage and what length of time?
The peso was something like more than doubled in about 5 months.
Wow.
Almost 6 months.
They doubled the supply.
They doubled the supply.
That
but
would
wait
be
a
like,
second.
Wow.
Wait. Let me stop you right there.
All right,
that's
right.
Why there's a lot that can be taken from the lessons of Argentina. I understand that the supply of U.S. dollars from the Federal Reserve Board was about $900 billion, something like 2 years ago, and you're now up to $1.9 trillion.
No, wait.
Supply
of what?
Dollars of the U.S. dollar.
You mean the dollars?
By the Federal Reserve Board.
The dollars that are owning. I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand what you're saying. The current money supply is in the it's in $17.5 trillion range.
Right, but it's doubled in the last 2 years.
The money supply?
Yes.
No.
In America?
No, not at all. I mean, the money supply has been gradually going up. It was like $1 trillion in 1980, and now it's $17 trillion. But it hasn't gone up 50% in the last 2 years.
I was looking at some statistics the other day, and there's been a very sharp increase over the last 2 years, Patrick. I can try and send you the actual source of that.
Yeah, I don't think that's correct at all. I mean, we talk about it every week with Andrew. He keeps really close tabs on it. As you know, I guess about 4 years ago, Mr. Salbucci, they quit giving us those numbers, right? You know, so now he's got to figure them out. Remember, they took it off the Fed website, the M3, the total.
That was the last thing Alan Greenspan did just before he left.
We're talking about total money supply, but I certainly agree, and we know that there's been at least $2 trillion new stuff out there. Is that what you're referring to in the last 2 years?
Yeah, that's the basic. But yeah,
okay,
I might be wrong when I say it's been double. What I'm saying is that there's been an extra $2 trillion.
You're right on there. To my knowledge, I think you're very accurate there. That's what we've been told as well from Andrew Goss. Yes.
But
in Argentina, though, they doubled the money supply.
Yes, that doubled the money supply here. That's why it went completely haywire.
Wow.
And I stand corrected on what you were just saying on the Federal Reserve. But the main point that I think I would like to mention on what hyperinflation really is all about is it's a question of trust. Why did the Argentine monetary system collapse? Because people just lost trust in the Argentinian peso at that time. Mm. And even more so, it meant that they lost their trust in the government, in the government's ability to put the economy back in place, to put the monetary system and the whole financial system back on its feet. Because, you see, when things are okay, economics can be a pretty exact science, econometrics even. Mm-hmm. But when things start going haywire and there's a big crisis, economy becomes much more of a branch of psychology. In other words, things go up or down, things may go well or they may go bad based on people's perceptions. And that's a very psychological aspect. So what I'm saying is that very often, if people still trust the government and trust their money, there might be no inflation, not even much less hyperinflation, even though the government is printing loads of dollars. Actually, America has been printing a lot of money over the past decade, and there's been very little inflation because people are still trusting the dollar, and above all, they still trust, although they complain, they still trust your government. The problem is the moment that people, and it runs like a brush fire, when people start saying, hey, there's something completely wrong here, and they lose trust in their authorities. That is probably the risk in a very different characteristic.
I see,
has happened in Argentina that is being run at this time in America, I think.
How are the Argentinians feeling about the dollar? Because I know that is your main currency, right?
Well, the dollar is still reigns supreme over here.
Uh-huh.
When people think of flight to safety, they have traditionally thought in Argentina in terms of dollars. If you want to buy a house, for example, you will never buy a house in pesos. You will buy a house that is priced in dollars because since the whole operation takes, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 months to go through, nobody would dream of buying or selling a house in pesos because anything can happen. In dollars, yes, that has given and still gives a feeling of stability. Perhaps in recent times, the euro has appeared on the horizon, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
But we are very much dollar-based and dollar-linked.
What do you make of this temporary, we believe it's temporary, but what do you make of this temporary strength in the dollar over the past couple of weeks?
Well, I think it's a sign that let me share with you another experience we had there that ties in with what you were saying.
Okay.
I'm wondering whether 2009 has not been the year where, unfortunately, the bankers, both those at the Federal Reserve as well as the ones in the Treasury Department, have done everything to help the banks that really were in trouble, the big banks, the ones that are too big to fail, to get their act right, the Goldman Sachs, the Banks of America, the Citicorp, and so forth. Because we had a similar effect here. In 2001, this is another state, we've had a lot of systemic crises. In 1989, we had hyperinflation. In 2001, we had a complete breakdown of our banking system, total collapse.
Wow.
Now, 1 year before that happened, that happened in December 2001. 1 year before that, in December 2000, when you look at it with hindsight, the government enacted and Congress followed through, enacted a series of measures that when you look at them with the wisdom of hindsight, were all geared on helping the banks get their act right. And once they more or less stabilized their own internal operations, then in, at the end of December 2001, the government completely blocked the monetary system. You could not get your money out of the bank, and the excuse was to avoid a run on the banks. The thing is that everybody lost their money, but not one single bank collapsed. Because you can see, it can be seen, we've analyzed this very closely down here, that all the measures taken by the government and Congress were geared on ensuring that the banks were stable. So the banks didn't lose money, but the people did. So I'm wondering if what is happening, and this is this rather false stability that we are living through, or that you are living through in America, with the bailout money and the TARP system and so forth, whether that is not being done to help the banks get their act right for when the time comes, where I, which is my own personal opinion, when I think the dollar will be so overissued, so technically hyperinflated, that you will have to change it for a new dollar.
And
a monetary conversion.
Oh, wow. So what would be the upside of that? Wouldn't that just get the masses just really angry and in revolutionary mode?
Well, it depends how you handle that. Let me share another example. We were in revolutionary and uprising in December 2001. I don't know if you remember from your news reports, but Argentinians, when they were told you cannot get your money out of the bank, they went with their pots and pans, literally, and they started to bang on all the bank doors. Think of it. This is December 2001. We're right in the middle of summer. People who were going to go on holidays didn't go on holidays. People who were going to take it easy could not take it easy. It was very hot. Everybody went out and literally kicked and banged on all the bank stores, but they did not get their money back.
That was countrywide. All the banks closed.
Nationwide, absolutely all. Wow. You could only take out to 250 pesos per week, which is like if I were saying, Patrick, you can only withdraw $100 a week from your bank.
And what was the reason given?
That it was the only way to preserve a generalized banking run on all banks.
I see. And what were they really doing?
Yeah. Now what actually happens is that they gave the banks the opportunity to keep the money, to keep all the deposits that they had, and to not give them back until the following happened. Everybody wanted to go to the bank and get their money out.
Right.
Nobody got
right.
it out. So what happened? They started banging on the doors. There was like a national uprising. Not so violent. I'm not going to exaggerate this. So this went on for a week. It went on for a month. It went on for another month. And after the fourth, the fifth month, we're already in 2002, say April, May 2002, they started liberalizing. And they said, well, you can get a little bit of your money out. And what happened is that people got used to the whole situation. And finally, 2 years later, when the whole thing was stabilized, they told people, okay, you can take some of your money out. But in the meantime, the whole system had been stabilized. So what happened? The banks were saved. People who had all their savings in dollars, which is the proper way to do it, not one of them got their dollars back. They all got pesos at very arbitrary rates of exchange. And what happened was that all that anger from the moment when the banking run was when the banking crisis was announced in December 2001, when you move forward to June 2002, December 2002, and then on 2003 and 2004, as the crisis went along, people got used to it, and it is a basic psychological factor that people will get used to it and say, well, what the hell, I'll see what I can do, the best I can do out of this, and I'll try and recover whatever I can.
That's amazing. I can't even imagine that happening here. They would burn the banks down. I mean, people for 5 months not only be able to get $100 a week out, it couldn't happen here. The people would not stand for it. They
wouldn't. Let me just clarify one point. I think it might stand in America even more than Argentina.
How
I'll tell
so?
You why.
How could it? Really? You think
because
that, you don't think the people would just freak out here?
Wait a second. In Argentina, because our banking system was and still is much more primitive than in America.
Right, right.
We do a lot of stuff with cash. So what the government said is you cannot have cash, but you can do bank remittances. So if you want to pay something to somebody else and you owe him, I don't know, 10,000 pesos, well, remit it. In other words, they allowed it to be done through the clearing system.
Oh, you mean you could still use credit and debits and all that?
Exactly.
Oh, this was, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. This was just the amount of cash you could pull out.
It was strictly the amount of cash. So in America, where you do a lot more banking operations, it might be much more manageable.
Yeah.
But the point...
They might be able to get away with that for a while.
Yeah.
If you could use your debit card, because most of this stuff is, what, 95% in this country is all electronic?
Yeah, that's why you have a much greater advantage than we had. When that happened here, only 50% of the population had any banking account whatsoever. So for half the population, they said it was business as usual. It was all the black economy type thing.
Wow, that's amazing.
Now, the thing that I think might be on the horizon is you might ask, well, why would the Federal Reserve do something so irrational or so illogical as that?
That was my
whenever you see something that looks illogical or irrational being done from high circles, I always tend to think, well, there must be something we're missing or there's something wrong, because you can say anything you like about American presidents and governors of the Federal Reserve Board and banking CEOs, but they are not stupid. That is the only thing you cannot say. They know what they're doing, pretty much. And what I'm wondering is, might there not be in the books a major monetary changeover, which is something that we've experienced, like I've experienced four or five in my lifetime in this country. And when I think of the United States, I often think, if you have a lot of fiat money that's been printed, those trillions of dollars we were discussing a little while ago in this conversation, and they're all out there, and but on top of it, much of it, perhaps most of it, is outside the borders of the United States, and it is not convertible into anything, neither gold nor silver nor anything else, might there not be in the works a new dollar which will be convertible into gold? And not just any gold. I often wonder what might it not be, and I have some people from America that have given me this information, a gold bullion that has embedded in it a foolproof chip or hologram or whatever, which will make it almost impossible to counterfeit. In other words, it would be, I call it sacred Federal Reserve gold. It's gold that has the chip in it, and there's no way that you can confuse that with normal, ordinary gold from your jewelry and so forth.
Right, right.
Now, if that were to occur and they were to say the new dollar is convertible, theoretically, into gold.
Inside and outside the United States?
Now, that's the point. You, as an American citizen, you probably would be able to go to your bank and say, I've got an old dollar, and they would just say, here's a new dollar, no problem. But there would be not enough dollars to go around for the whole world. So when somebody like me, I'm an Argentinian citizen, and maybe my savings are in, I don't know, 10,000 old dollars, the American government could legally say, sorry, guys, we just don't have enough new dollars to go around. What would probably have happened is that a black market would start arising in every country, and people would say, well, how do I get rid of these old dollars? And somebody might say, well, I'll take 10 old dollars for one new dollar. And that would be the equivalent of transferring a major part of the loss, the hyperinflationary loss, to other geographies of the world, South America, Latin America, Africa, and so forth.
And the United States people probably wouldn't really, most people wouldn't have a clue of what was going on, because they don't understand.
And let's be very fair about this. When you have a crisis, there's a lot of every man for himself type thing.
Sure,
so if an American citizen were to see, well, you know, at least I have my back covered, they're not really going to be too concerned about what happens to somebody in South America or in the Far East and so forth. You see, your crises, your monetary crises, affect the whole world. The reason why nobody has hardly ever heard about the ones in Argentina is because when Argentina blows its act the way we did recurrently, the only people who are really harmed have been ourselves.
Right.
Because it never actually left the borders of Argentina.
But it's just the opposite. When America sneezes, right, the whole world catches a cold, and just because it's a dollar, it's because the dollar is supreme. And we've been told, and I believe this is an accurate number, that there are four times as many dollars outside the United States as there are inside.
I've read that too.
That's pretty wild, isn't it?
And you have the additional problem that a lot of those are counterfeit currency anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So you're suggesting that this might be an interesting way for the boys, the Federal Reserve, and the powers that be that control the dollar, to get rid of some of this hyperinflation blow off kind of thing, to not allowing that to happen, where they could just devalue the dollars outside of the U.S. But wouldn't you, if you had 10,000 in Argentina, wouldn't you just take your 10,000, sneak it into the country, so you could get one for one, sneak it into the United States?
Well, I would imagine, Patrick, that there would be strong controls in place. In other words, the trade of new dollars for old dollars would probably be to anybody, whether it be an individual or a corporation, that can show that it is either domiciled in the United States or that it is an actual American citizen in the case of an individual or American corporation. So if I were to sneak in, they would probably want to say, well, let me just see your passport. And when I produce my passport, it would say Argentine Republic, and they would say, sorry, we'd love to, but we can't. You see, what that would help to do is to bring the dollar, at least the new dollar, rather, on par with the euro. Because if you look at the euro, for example, as an alternative global currency, the euro is extremely strong technically. In other words, if you were to go to the European Central Bank in Frankfurt and ask them, hey, how many of these euro notes have you issued? They could probably give you the exact number to the cent, because it's only been going since 2001, and they were probably able to say it's so many zillion, trillion, blah, blah, blah.
Whatever.
With 25 cents, fine. With the dollar, the Fed cannot do that, and that's why there's a whole movement trying to audit the Fed, because they've been issuing a lot of dollars, trillions of dollars, for a long, long time, and probably it's a very closely guarded secret exactly how many dollars are out there. That's why Alan Greenspan, just before Bernard Bernanke took over, gave him that little present of saying, we're no longer going to give the, I think it's the M3 factor, sure, publicly on our website. So if anything, the new dollar would come on par with the euro. You would know exactly how many have been issued, but naturally you're going to have to issue a lot less new dollars, and it's just not going to be enough to go around for the old dollars, because if you printed enough to go around, you would be hyperinflating the currency again.
We're talking about that.
The relationship between new dollars and old dollars will give us, in hindsight, an idea of just how hyperinflated the present dollar actually is. But that when that is known, it won't be a problem, because the old dollar will no longer be enforced. It's the new dollar that counts.
We're talking with Adrian Salbucci. He's an economist. You can check him out on YouTube. He's got a lot of really interesting videos from a different perspective that we might get, and that's why we enjoy talking to him from time to time. And he has written a couple of books in Spanish on the Council on Foreign Relations and Geopolitics. It is the 28th of December. We're recording this just before Christmas here on OneRadioNetwork.com. We'll be live back tomorrow morning on OneRadioNetwork.com on Tuesday morning, the 29th. Mr. Salbucci, what do you think? What is your sense of Europeans, other places around the world, and the international scene of the worry or concern about something like this happening with the dollar, with a real hyperinflation, or a new dollar coming in for those outside the United States? Is you hear this concern, or is this just more Adrian Salbucci, who's kind of a visionary in these ideas, giving us your opinion what could possibly happen?
Well, what I see, Patrick, is a lot of concern outside of the United States. Not so much in Europe, because the Europeans definitely have what you can clearly call and describe as a very strong currency, the euro.
And they have
so
the pound,
euro,
right?
Is okay. Yeah. And that should not be a problem. But other regions where the euro is a foreign currency, like in South America and so forth, there is growing concern. So that explains, I think, why gold, for example, has become such an attractive flight to safety commodity, and why many people, as I say, here down in Argentina are starting to consider the euro. And you have an added problem which might fuel the whole crisis, and it can fuel it very suddenly, and that's that many of the oil-producing countries, some of which are not very friendly towards the United States, the case of Iran, the case of Venezuela, are seriously considering and have even migrated from selling their oil in the U.S. dollar markets towards selling oil in the euro markets.
But now, have they not been threatening that for a long time, Mr. Salbucci? Hasn't that been out there for a long time that's never really come to pass? Well, I guess it has come to pass in Iran. They're doing it they're not doing it for dollars anymore, are they?
No, yeah, Iran finally
has gone
over to the euro. Now, the main markets, the New York mercantile market, the London market, and the market in Dubai, they're still in dollar-based. Now, the thing is, will there be enough political clout on the part of non-friendly oil-producing countries that might be able to take a sizable portion, even eventually all of the oil market, away from the dollar, especially if the dollar does become less trustworthy, mm-hmm. let's put it that way, as the months go by. You know, we would have to see what Russia does about this. Well, we have to see what China does about this.
And that would weaken it. That would weaken it further, right? Yeah. So
there's a lot of oil geopolitics behind this.
What do you think is going on as far as wars and invasions and stuff? I mean, it's not hard to. You don't have to be Nostradamus to know that something's going to happen in Iran, and something big is happening in Afghanistan. What is your opinion of what this whole Afghanistan thing is about? I heard on the radio this morning, this is curious, and I believe it was accurate. It was a pretty interesting report that they have a couple hundred thousand service people in that area, you know, in the Iran, Afghanistan, but they have an equal number of private contractors, and there's over a half of a million Americans in that area being paid to do something. I'm not sure what it is.
Well, perhaps Blackwater is the key word here. Now they've changed their name to something like TX Security mm-hmm. Consultants or something like that. But yes, this is probably one of the Iraq war started the whole concept of outsourcing wars not to other armed forces, but rather to private companies as a whole. Now, I think that what President Barack Obama is doing in Afghanistan is really greatly dangerous play, not just because of Afghanistan. Think of it. Nobody has ever been able to conquer Afghanistan. Hmm. The English couldn't. Right. The Soviets couldn't. Right. And America hasn't been able to. But this is very much targeting Pakistan. And let's not forget that Pakistan can be easily destabilized, even thrown into a civil war from a stronghold in Afghanistan. And Pakistan, unfortunately, has nuclear armament. Now, again, there's a lot of oil regarding Afghanistan. Not that Afghanistan has oil, but it is the natural territory through which major oil pipelines should go, whether it be to UNOCAL for the United States, where both Condoleezza Rice and Mr. Karzai are very strong supporters of, or whether it be the Chinese who want to have Iranian oil through a pipeline that needs to go through various territories, and Afghanistan would be an option. And definitely China would love to have a direct pipeline into the Iranian oil because of their strong growth and so forth. So as I say, a lot of what's happening in Asia and all those wars are strictly linked to the energy factor, mm-hmm. except for the threat on Iran, which is very much linked to the security of the state of Israel or the perceived security of the state of Israel.
Uh-huh. And so do you perceive these as all wild cards in the dollar and the value thereof in the next couple of years, all these possible geopolitical Achilles heels sort of things that could happen?
Yes, and probably the weakest point here, because there is a very strong, irrational factor, is the unflinching support that the United States of America has permanently given to the foreign policy of the State of Israel as far as its enemies in the region are concerned. So since the failed invasion of Lebanon in mid-2006, it's an open secret that Israel plans on attacking Iran. I mean, they keep publishing it in their newspapers, and they keep declaring it. Mr. Netanyahu just declared, I think, to the Daily Telegraph in London and so forth. Now, when that happens, unfortunately, it will drag America into a major war in the region, and that is very dangerous because Iran is not Iraq. I mean, Saddam Hussein didn't have a friend in the world, and nobody came out to help him at all, and mm-hmm. quite rightly, if anything. Mm-hmm. But the Iranians are a very different stock altogether, and it will be rather difficult. I think it already is difficult for Israel and America to satanize Iran because, okay, you might like Iran, you might not like Iran, but the historical fact is that in the last 100 years, Iran has invaded they have not attacked anybody. They have not attacked any of their neighbors. And contrary-wise, Iran was repeatedly invaded by Britain and the Soviet Union during World War II. They had a later after the war, they had a democratic government with their prime minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who nationalized the Anglo-Iranian oil company. Today, it's called British Petroleum. And so the CIA and MI6 made a coup d'état and they got rid of him, and they installed the Pavlevi family, who were extremely repressive and authoritarian. And even yet, still, Iran, time and again, have been more the victims of Western aggression than the actual perpetrators. Now, that doesn't mean that what they did with the American embassy in 1979 is totally, totally unacceptable. You cannot take embassies. That is, but aside from that, and I don't think anybody even got killed there. They just did a very nasty thing for 500 and some odd days. Iran has not been a threat to its neighbors. Now, Iran, however, is permanently being threatened by Israel, and Israel does have a record of having invaded other countries, or what they're doing in Gaza, what they've done in Lebanon, and America is permanently invading countries there, like the cases of Iraq and Afghanistan, and even the attacks into Pakistan would give a lot of credibility to the fact that, well, if a war were to affect there, the aggressor would probably not be Iran, but it will be Israel in the first instance, and then, unfortunately, America that will see itself being dragged into that. And that will impact on the dollar. Part of the problem with the dollar today is the cost of the Iraq war.
And, you know, as you probably well know, Mr. Salbucci, that all of this activity in Iran and Afghanistan is really kind of an off-the-books thing. I mean, it's not even in the defense budget, which is pretty interesting. Isn't that interesting how they can have a $600 billion defense budget, but Iran and Iraq is not even in that budget?
But the money is coming out of somewhere. So that, I think, might help to understand why the Federal Reserve, under no circumstances, will they have their books audited by anybody.
It's not going to happen, is it? It isn't. Yeah. It's not going to happen. Where do you perceive in the coming years would be some of the safe places to be? Do you feel comfortable there with your family in Argentina? And are there other places in the world that may weather this tumultuous times in the next few years better than others?
Well, I have to admit that I feel comfortable in Argentina in general terms, not in the city of Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires is a huge city. It's bigger than New York City, just to give you an idea. I mean, it's really very huge, really? Very overpopulated and so forth. So if things really start having – if there is a social breakdown in different parts of the world, Buenos Aires is going to suffer as much as any other city. Uh-huh. But in general terms, Argentina does have the attraction of being territorially very big, geographically very far away from the probable war scenes and war stages that one can envision, whether it be in the Middle East or even in the Far East. And as I say, we have seven times the territory of France, for example, but only 40 million people, very badly distributed. But if you go down south to Patagonia, which is also on both on the Argentinian and Chilean side, that's the Atlantic and the Pacific coast, it is very sparsely populated. It has all the natural resources you could possibly imagine. So if anything, I would say, well, this is not a bad part of the world to be. But as I say, Patrick, if we were to have a worldwide turmoil, whether it be social turmoil or a war, well, with today's technologies, unfortunately, there's probably nowhere you can run and hide.
It's so interesting how the New World Order, the boys, the CFR and the World Bank and the IMF got their hooks into Argentina, and they've got you guys as on the dollar. Would you not be better off, or do you have that's probably a naive question, but are there could you possibly run the peso without the dollar and do better? I mean, would there ever be a chance?
Absolutely. Every country can run its own currency much better than basing itself on another country's currency, for the simple reason that you have no control over another country's currency.
Sure.
But for better or for worse, you have control over your own. Now, when Argentina in the 50s, we did do something that probably ended in the government at that time being finally ousted, since after the war, Argentina had a lot of credits from Britain and other European countries that had been devastated by World War II. The Argentine government started selling its products in Argentinian pesos. What do I mean by that? They told, for example, Argentina told France and Germany, to take two specific examples, let me pay for your tractors and for other equipment that we need in pesos, because when you receive those pesos, you can in turn use those pesos to buy our meat and our grains and our wheat. So we started to use the Argentine peso as a currency in within Europe. As a matter of fact, the French and the Germans even traded amongst themselves in part. There were some operations in pesos because both of them liked having pesos because they can then use that to buy food to feed their people. So a government can do, a sovereign government can do a lot to really promote its own currency and thus promote its own economic growth. What happened in Argentina is that it's a very dreadful but simple process. Instead of us being invaded, which is very nasty, invasions look very bad in the 6 o'clock news, as Vietnam and Iraq show, they in turn just selected very carefully, and this has been the job of organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations, mind you, they just very carefully selected who are the locals, the natives, the indigenous people who are willing to sell off their country, or who at least are willing to do what we want them to do with their country. They identify them, they finance their political parties, their political campaigns, they're being permanently in the news and in the mainstream media, and then they catapult them into becoming the president. Through financing the people that they identified as the right people to sort of do defend their own interests, they were catapulted, these local Argentinian individuals, into later becoming presidents and governors and senators and representatives, so that the right legislation would be put in place that would enable these people to do what the foreign bankers actually wanted. And the main thing that they did is that they generated a horrendous foreign debt, which today is totally unpayable and acts as the main conditioning factor, probably the main conflict or theoretical conflict that Argentina would have if it wants to get itself back on its feet. And the interesting part is that if you look at today's foreign debt that Argentina has, most of it can be traced back to the illegal military regime that usurped power between 1976 and 1983. Wow. And we could thus declare that as odious debt. So it would have to be investigated. So in a way, from the point of view of the powers that be, all they have to do is finance those local politicians that will never, ever even dream of investigating Argentina's foreign debt. Yeah. They will just roll it over and say, okay, let's refinance it 1, 2, 10, 20 times.
We're going to really delve into this, Mr. Salbucci, with a man that I'm sure you've heard about, John Perkins, and Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He has a new book, and we're going to have him on One Radio Network very, very soon, within the next week or so. To that end, do you know the amount of money that Argentina owes these power brokers and the, let's call them, the New World Order, when they were going through this installation of their favorite people down there? Do you know the amount of money owed?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. This is something that we have a lot of people. We have a very good team working on this right now. The official figure accepted by the Argentinian government is of about $200 billion.
That's not a lot of money. That's what I was just going to say. Well, that's not a lot of money these days.
But you see, what happens is that from the point of view of the American economy, $200 billion is a piece of cake.
Right.
But for us, it's a lot of money because that is equivalent to our gross domestic product, our gross national product.
Really?
And the thing is that it's been done in such a way that whilst this debt until the early 90s was in the hands of about 20 specific banks and would have enabled us to ask those specific banks, well, why do we owe you this money and what does it refer to?
Right.
In 1992, Nicholas Brady, hand in hand with our local government here, unfortunately, succeeded in getting the government to change that debt with the banks, turning it into debt bonds in the hands of about 2.5 million people. So it became completely anonymous, and it's very difficult now to actually work the whole thing backwards so that we would know, well, what do we owe to whom and why? And that is probably the key question that Argentina should be asking.
Sure.
Why do I owe this money, and who do I owe this money to?
Who do I owe it to?
But that has to be investigated by an Argentinian government. We can't expect Citibank or the IMF to take the first step.
Well, you probably owe it to them, right? Citibank.
In part.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, it's basically basically those banks. Yeah.
I guess it could be argued too, Adrian Salbucci, that if you stop making those payments, that somebody's going to come knocking on your door, collective door.
Yeah, and there's also another thing, and I think this might be a point worth making because it refers to Argentina, but I think it refers to just about any other country having a major debt. And you might even correct me and say that it even refers to the United States.
Uh-huh.
I was telling you a few seconds ago that Argentina owes about $200 billion in foreign debt.
Right.
If by a miracle we were able to issue a check tonight for $200 billion and give it to all the bankers and say, here's all your money, we don't need you anymore, just go away and don't come back.
Mm-hmm.
I think that whatever president were to do that, he would be immediately shot. And I'll tell you why.
Hmm.
Because we would be generating two major problems to the banking system. First problem, what do they do with another $200 billion? Where do they invest that? And the second and much more serious problem is that Argentina would be cutting asunder these invisible golden chains that keep us tied up to their financial system. In other words, we become a free country where we can develop things the way we best fit. They would, the whole system, the whole international, the powers that be, so to speak, would not be able to control this anymore. So if anything, the debt is the excuse whereby they control us. You probably read, and I'm sure many of our listeners have also read, the Merchant of Venice, Shylock, the usurer. He doesn't want to have his 3,000 ducats back.
Of course
he wants
not.
To have his pound of flesh. And a friend of the Merchant of Antonio says, well, I'll double it. I'll give you 6,000. I'll give you 9,000. And the usurer, Shylock, keeps saying, no, I want my bond. I want the pound of flesh. So in Argentina, the pound of flesh is natural resources, continuing weakness in the government, the country never getting on its feet, so that the powers that be, through their energy companies and through their mining companies and through their tourism companies even and through their foodstuff companies, will know that they can have almost irrestricted access to Argentine raw materials at rock bottom prices.
Interesting. How prevalent is the knowledge of the thumb of the power brokers of the world have on the country of Argentina? Is that knowledge out there? Do many people, most people, some people? How would you talk about that?
Absolutely, almost zero, nothing.
Really?
Nothing. We are really fighting an uphill battle because our media here, especially in a country which, except for the last 10 or 15 years where technology has brought in cable TV and a host of other stuff, throughout the decades, we have been quite isolated. So probably only one out of every 1,000 Argentinians has an inkling of this.
That's however, crazy.
When I start mentioning these things, as I often try and do on the radio or on TV, it generates a lot of interest.
I bet it does.
Which is good. But as I was saying at the beginning of the program, my book is probably the only book in Spanish that talks about these things. And it is relatively, I won't say widely read because it's not millions of people, but a lot of people have read it and it's still going there because people want to sort of know. They want to have an explanation as to why the things that, the dreadful things that are happening to us and that are now happening the world over, why they happen so consistently. But there's still an enormous process of education that has to be carried out in America, for example, well, much, much more so in Argentina.
Do you know, Adrian Salbucci, is this paradigm that we just described through the Federal Reserve and the IMF and the World Bank and the power brokers of the world and having their thumb, this goes on a lot around the world, does it not?
Well, you see, I have, my own vision of that is that you probably heard that with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, we started talking about privatization,
right?
The privatization of the railways and I don't know, the telephone companies and the power companies and so forth. Now, what people don't realize is that there has been one huge, monstrous privatization, and it has been the privatization of real political power.
Hmm.
The power to run the world has fallen into private hands, and those private hands will run your monetary system, your banking system, your corporations, your main universities who actually spread the paradigms through for the future people who will be the ruling class.
Sure.
And very specifically, your government. The American government has always been in the hands, the key posts have always been in the hands of people who are related to the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and so forth. The CFR have a very cute phrase. They say, no matter who wins the elections, we are in power.
Hmm.
And they mean mean it. They it's true, because they are the ones who are actually determining what foreign policy will be, what monetary policy will be, and so forth. It's no coincidence that the very people who are the architects of the global financial crisis that started in America are the same people who are now in the Obama government. Mr. Geithner, Mr. Rubin in behind the scenes, Mr. Lawrence Summers, and okay, you have Bernanke who has succeeded Alan Greenspan. It's all part of the same group of people, unfortunately, yeah. Irrespective of the party and irrespective of the electoral process.
Just as a side thought, I don't want to give her a hard time. She's not here to defend herself. But Chelsea Clinton, I just saw where she married some big shot at Goldman Sachs.
Does that surprise you?
Yeah, I read that and I said, well, it doesn't surprise me.
What did you expect her to marry? A nice Brooklyn boy?
It's just crazy, man. So what are you going to be up to here in 2010? What do you see? Can you make a few predictions of what you're going to be seeing here? What we're going to be seeing of the dollar and geopolitics and...
Yeah, one of the things that we always say, at least I say, we don't make predictions, we make forecasts, because predictions sound like a little bit of, you know, the crystal ball sort of thing.
Right.
What we try and do is, with the data which is at hand and all the stuff that one can read in the newspapers and in books and talking to people like such as yourself and so forth, is learn what the tendencies are. And when you look at it, well, I think it's rather obvious, if anything, that we are heading straight into a financial meltdown, not a crisis. It's an actual meltdown.
Of
the better part of the system.
Wow.
And that is going to drag with it an economic collapse. Because you see, the thing, Patrick, is that the economy, even today, but especially in September 2008 when the whole crisis broke loose, the world economy is pretty much intact. What is definitely gone completely haywire is the financial system. The financial system, which should always be subordinated to the real economy, has usurped the place that does not rightfully belong to it and has positioned itself way above the real economy. So now we have a financial system that is sort of like a cancerous tumor. It has gone into metastasis by not just over-issuing of the dollar, but by over-issuing of huge virtual financial instruments such as your derivatives. Between you and me, I come from insurance. Derivatives are insurance products, and insurance requires very strict reinsurance and a whole system to make sure that nothing goes wrong, whilst these derivatives were just issued very, very happily, and now they are trillions and trillions of dollars, and there's nothing that the whole system can do about it. That's why I think we are headed to a financial meltdown that unhappily will drag the real economy into social collapse, which will in turn, or at least in some countries, which will in turn generate social upheavals. And when you have that triad, financial meltdown, economic collapse, and social upheaval, then the powers that be are going to have to use a lot of creativity to see how they control the masses so that, like they did in Argentina, we'll let them bang on the bank doors, they're not going to get their money back, and let's see how we can sort of carry and manage, crisis manage our way through.
Well, as you well know, Ben Bernanke, Man of the Year, Time Magazine, all of the mainstream media in the United States, Adrian Salbucci, they're singing a different tune. Things have turned around. We've turned the corner. Things are getting better. Things are straightening out. I mean, it's still slow and a lot of unemployment, but it's getting better. So the disconnect here, you're predicting a financial meltdown worldwide, and when? Or you're forecasting, forecasting.
Yeah, rather, I wouldn't know if it would be worldwide because, as I say, I don't know if China is going to be directly affected by this. If anything, China might even be able to trigger it because of all their U.S. dollar denominated assets, and the same thing with some other countries in that area. What I would say is that we are going to see a generalized meltdown starting probably in the United States and going on into Europe or vice versa, or the U.K. at least. Now, when you look at it from that point of view, what I would say is that what they are saying now is that, and I can understand this, they are trying to generate trust in the system. In other words, it's easy to make the Dow go up or down.
Sure.
I mean, these things can be manipulated. And I think it's understandable that they should try and generate trust so that people will continue investing in corporations and will continue using their banks and so forth. Mm-hmm. But in a way, very often, it gives me the idea of the proverbial guy who jumped off the 20th floor with a cell phone phone, and he rang a friend and he said, I'm on the 10th floor and everything's just fine so far. So, you know, in a way, I know it's a silly example, but that very often I feel that that is – because, you see, when you look at the numbers themselves, when you look at the 500 – I think it's the amount is even higher now. 800 trillion was the last amount that I saw in the New York Times, actually. It's $800 trillion worth of derivatives.
Right.
Who is going to support all that loss? And when there is a big loss out there, it's always the underdog, the little guy who ends up paying it, and not the big guy. As we saw, you know, all the bankers ended up getting their bonuses, but not the employees down there. The employees were just kicked. Many of them were just kicked out. But the big brass, the people who have the real power are the ones that are probably going to save themselves.
And what would be what would be some of the signs, and do you forecast this to be starting in 2010? What would be some of the signs that it's happening?
Well, I think some of the signs will be probably twofold. And again, I'm just going to refer to the example we had in Argentina. If you don't read the signs as they are going correctly, then everything happens, unfortunately, very suddenly. During 2001, when we had our dread for financial systemic crisis, actually it was a systemic breakdown of our whole banking and monetary system, there were signs, but everything was very stable. There was no inflation. It was one peso equals $1 because it was our peso was completely pegged by law to the dollar. Congress enacted a law that said that your banking assets were untouchable. So people said, okay, I'm just fine. I'm just great.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, on the 30th of November, I can give you the exact date, 30th November 2001, everything collapsed. The government was thrown out, literally thrown out. They had to leave. And we had, you might remember, we had seven presidents in 1 week.
I remember that. I remember.
It was so, everything went so haywire. So everything collapsed very suddenly. And that false stability of one peso, $1, all of a sudden became $1, 4 pesos. We had a 400% devaluation of the peso.
Mm.
So I would say if you look at the macro numbers, the big numbers, the amounts of derivatives that are out there, the Obama deficit, the bailout, the TARP plan and so forth, and then you say, is this consistent with a Dow which is so nicely stable at 10,400? Is this consistent or is somebody manipulating it? And what I would say is it probably somebody manipulating it. We just learned that AIG, whose insurance side was supposed to be stable, it was just the derivatives that were bad, they lost something like $10 billion in their property and casualty portfolio. Why? Because they fiddled around with the figures. And then you discover that you had a Mr. Madoff who was he was the president of NASDAQ, and he was supposed to be one of the top, I won't say the top banker, but an important banker in Wall Street. All of a sudden, we realized that his whole company was a sham. So these are the things that are sort of coming out of this horrendous black hole. But people are not stupid all the time. And I think that as people realize that they are being manipulated, even by the media, even by the government, understandably, to generate trust, and that is being done artificially, well, you go from trust to total lack of trust very quickly.
Do you have any feelings, and we're kind of short on time, but have feelings on where you see gold and silver prices in 2010, if you forecast that?
Yeah, that I think is skyrocketing. I was reading where I think something like almost $1,300 now with gold, and I was reading that when you get to $2,200, I don't know, all hell is supposed to break loose. I'm not a gold expert, but I would imagine that at some point people are going to realize, well, why is gold rising? And the reason why gold is rising is because people are getting rid of their dollar-denominated financial assets and having a huge flight to safety. So when the panic goes through, it's like a run on a bank. Everything's okay. And then when you see, hey, everybody's going down the street. Why? They're all going to the bank. Why? They want to get their money out. Well, then you're going to go running out and getting your money back, getting your money out too. So in a way, it has a lot to do with a sudden lack of trust. And I think that gold, the price of gold, is a good indication of where that lack of trust is going.
Is there a keen awareness in metals and commodities, hard assets in Argentina?
No. You just have the gold awareness, and that's about it. So it's not a sophisticated market at all.
Uh-huh. Well, Mr. Salbucci, it's always fun to have you on the air. Thanks a lot. Adrian Salbucci. Now, folks, what do they do? Can they just put you in the search engine there on YouTube and
yes,
look at some of your videos?
And
you put
that? They can just type in Salbucci in YouTube, or they can look at my website, which is www.adriansalbucci.com. asalbucci, that's asalbucci.com.r.
Uh-huh. And then you put up regular editions on YouTube, huh? All about world economic things.
I try to do that, and I just put one on with a forecast for 2010 is the latest video that's in YouTube. So anybody who wants to watch it and give me their opinion, I try to answer all emails I get.
Terrific. Mr. Salbucci, thanks for being with us on this December day, and you have a pleasant New Year there. You do celebrate New Year's in Buenos Aires?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, it's a good opportunity to say Happy New Year to you and,
Happy
and
New Year
to all
you,
your
sir.
Listeners.
Thank you very much, sir. See you soon.
See you. Cheers.
Okay. Adrian Salbucci in Buenos Aires. And Happy New Year to you. And I'll be back with you live and in the flesh here tomorrow morning, Tuesday morning, the 29th of December 2009. As we wrap up the year with a whole week's worth of cool stuff on finances. Andrew Goss on Wednesday. Rob Kirby out of Canada. On Thursday, Andrew Goss on Wednesday. Cool stuff. I love you all very much. Patrick Timpone, take care of yourself. Know the Source on One Radio Network.